This is the TTY Dialer, episode 48, for the week of October 1st through October 7th. Hi there. Welcome to your weekly companion to WRVO's old-time radio show tuned to yesterday. I'm Mark Livonier. Every single night of the week, live on the air, I bring you Golden Age of Radio drama, comedy, mystery, suspense, westerns, romance, science fiction, and much more from 10 to midnight and streaming live as it happens at WRVO.org. And this weekly podcast brings you a mix of radio history, fun with sound from radio's past, and a look at the shows coming up for the week, which we will sort of depart from this week, as a radio event came across my radar and seemed pretty interesting, and I wanted to talk to the person who put it together, and I'll be bringing you that conversation in just a moment. It's with BBC World Service manager and producer Dominic DeLarghi. He wrote and produced a three-hour special called The Golden Age of American Radio, and it was just aired late last month on BBC's Radio 4 Extra, hosted by comedian Toby Haydock, and it brought English listeners there a tour of what American radio sounded like in the mid-20th century, as in the time we mainly focus on here on the podcast and on the nightly show. But it was really well put together, 6 full broadcasts and a lot of asides as well in terms of clips of The War of the Worlds and the Lux Radio Theater, among others. And after listening to this, I really wondered how a BBC radio producer came to want to put together a special that did take a lot of work about the vast subject that is the Golden Age of Radio in the States. Dominic, welcome to the Tune to Yesterday Dialer podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be on.
Tell me a little bit about your background in radio and audio production.
Well, my day job is I'm a studio manager for the BBC, the BBC World Service. My qualification, I did an MA in radio production, and I've always had an interest in old radio. Well, old everything, really. Old films, old books, old magazines. And it was during my MA, which is about 12 years ago now, that I started to hear this phrase, old-time radio, which I'm kind of against. I tend to call it golden age radio. I don't know how you feel about that. And I'd wrote a thesis about the history of American political talk radio. And when I was doing this research, I was coming up with all sorts of very, very old programs. And then I came across, I think the first thing I heard was The Adventures of Superman.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
I thought this is interesting.
Up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman.
I just started to sort of explore around and came across all sorts of different shows. Then I came across a podcast called Comic Web. It gave me a bit of an overview that'd be science fiction one week and detectives the next week and maybe a kids show the following week. So from then, about 11 years ago, I started to kind of collect shows in MP3. And then a few years ago, I noticed that 4 Extra, who are in the same building but a million miles away in lots of respects from the work I was doing, had broadcast some episodes of, I think they did an episode of Suspense. I think they did Sorry, Wrong Number. Or something else, I can't quite remember now. There's a little season of them, but I think they'd come, they're without any context, and there didn't seem to be anybody at the BBC who was kind of curating them. I think they came as a package with other American shows, more modern shows. And I thought, oh my God, this is my stuff, this is my era, this is what I know about. I say I know about it compared to people I've met in the last couple of years. I know nothing, but, you know, as far as the BBC was concerned, I was the biggest expert they had on the subjects. So I went to them and I said, I'd like to do a programme. And my first idea was a series, and I kind of thought maybe an hour a week on different themes, maybe science fiction one week and then westerns or whatever it might be. But this three-hour special was suggested instead, which would give lots of little samples and tasters for a UK audience. We have lots of restrictions over here because we're a large, quite high-profile broadcaster. We have to dot all the I's and cross all the T's when it comes to rights and permissions and that kind of thing. So we did a lot of that kind of stuff. It's a different country. We were wading through lots and lots of red tape to get it all on air. But, you know, eventually, once you get through to the right person, it happens very quickly, you know. So I think I did about a year's work just on admin, really, and then about 4 months writing the show and putting it all together. And it felt like a long process to get it on air. But it seems to have gone down very well. It was Pick of the Week in Radio Times, which is the kind of the UK listings magazine, and another website. It was a Pick of the Week on there. And people seem to be happy with it, which is quite gratifying.
Congratulations on that, on the reception, yeah. Choosing the shows for that three-hour window to play in a country that maybe today is completely unfamiliar, I'm thinking that probably couldn't have been the easiest, because there's just so much out there, as you know, that's been preserved. So tell me how that went. Was it more of academic choices you were making, or instinct?
I was trying to balance the things that I liked against the things that I thought, because you're always trying to think who your audience is. And I could have played, you know, my six favourite programmes, which probably would have been all quite similar. Four Extra were quite keen for me to have some big names in there, which is quite easy to do. You know, you could fill the 3 hours, much more than 3 hours, with all sorts of big Hollywood names. I was quite keen to get some lesser-known people in there as well. So I was balancing that kind of the big Hollywood names and the people that I wanted to sneak in, like Jack Webb and Lorraine Tuttle, were two quite important people I wanted to get in there. I wanted it to be a balance of kind of, you know, different genres. So there's The Saint, which is a detective for all intents and purposes.
The Adventures of The Saint, starring Vincent Price.
Suspense was like a movie on the air. And I wanted to get the 1 out of 7 Jack Webb piece in, because I just think it's an amazing piece of radio.
Yeah, no, let me set that up for my listeners here. So that was one of the choices in the list of about 6 shows plus a lot of excerpts that really grabbed me. It was a basically news dramatized by the soon-to-be Dragnet creator and star Jack Webb, called 1 out of 7. Can you describe that show beyond its brilliance? Maybe a deeper reason why you showcased it or decided to? Because it's pretty obscure, really.
It is. It's quite an obscure program. And when I was mentioning that as a possibility to some people in the OTR community, quite a few people hadn't heard of it, which made me actually keener to use it, because I thought, oh, well, it's something interesting for the American audience as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, the material and quotations used on the following program are taken from authentic news reports off the wires of Associated Press and International News Service. We present this material without editorial comment, since this station takes no official stand on any controversial question. We can, therefore, assume no responsibility for the attitude such statements reflect.
From San Francisco, the American Broadcasting Company presents 1 out of 7.
Shortly after the Second World War, Jack Webb and a writer called Jim Moser, working in San Francisco, and they would take a news story from the previous 7 days and they'd dramatise it, and Jack Webb would usually play most of the parts, and they're often quite political. The line I wrote in the script for the show was, he had a campaigning spirit and was passionately anti-racist, and it was quite a big thing of his, anti-racism, Jack Webb. And also he was very into his jazz as well, obviously lots of black musicians in the jazz world. And the first episode, which is the one we played in the programme, was called Senator Theodore Bilbo. And for those people who don't know, Senator Bilbo was a senator from Mississippi, I think, who was an extreme racist by any standards. I would have thought standards even of that time. He's a member of the Ku Klux Klan, very, very, very unpleasant man, didn't like Negroes, as he referred to black people. I had to do quite a big compliance form, actually, when I was putting the programme together. I'd say he has these racially provocative terms in there. We had to say in the introduction, you know, it has these jarring racial terms, but it's acceptable for the audience, even though it went out at 9 o'clock in the morning, UK time.
Adjust your dials most carefully, citizens. Herewith presenting Senator Theodore Bilbo, picture number 1.
Because the piece is clearly so, he's painted as such an unsympathetic character, Senator Bilbo, and portrayed by Jack Webb as this kind of like Doc Hogg, but a nasty kind of guy. So that was quite a powerful piece. And what he does is it's similar to, also in the programme, I say the line is something like, with shades of Shakespeare's Mark Antony, damns him with his own words. So what he does is he basically does verbatim speeches that Bilbo made in the Senate. and just reads them in character. And then there are a couple also of scenes that are kind of written, imagined and written by Jim Moser, and imagined improvised by Jack Webb as well. He keeps saying all the way through, we're not saying anything. We don't want to impugn his personality or his integrity. He is an honourable man. He's a US senator. It feels in a way quite dated now. And I think that's partly, well, two reasons. I think partly because it has this quite cheesy kind of organ music, you know, that kind of Hammond organ that was quite ubiquitous in some radio from the time. And also there's a scene over in Europe somewhere, there's a black soldier who is writing home to his mum, and it's slightly kind of, it just feels a bit corny. He's saying that everybody's blood is red, and for a modern audience, that felt slightly laying it on a bit thick, really. But, you know, at the time, it would have been very powerful, you know. And it is, the whole thing is quite powerful now. And of the shows, the feedback I've had from people, that's the one that people have been most interested in.
With all the listening that you've done before this project even came to be and the previewing for your special, sometimes with a project, you get really married to material before it ends up getting cut. So it could be a really hard process. Were there any shows like that for you that you really wanted to get in, or you just thought, I just can't do this for whatever reason?
Oh, I mean, I didn't use most of the shows I wanted to use, you know. I mean, I only had 3 hours. I had a list of maybe 15 shows. I wanted to use some episodes of Escape. That's one of my favourite shows. I would like to have used maybe... I'm not actually a huge fan of science fiction, but I do like it on the radio. I would like to maybe use Dimension X, an episode of that. There's some very kind of quirky Dimension X and X-1. They're kind of science fiction-y, but a bit tongue-in-cheek as well. Would have been quite nice. I also had an episode of Damon Runyon Theatre lined up.
About as American as it can get with that dialogue.
Exactly. Yeah. Maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I got into reading P.G. Wodehouse's short stories, Jeeves and Wooster. Ridiculously kind of absurdly English, or pretend English, really. And then I kind of devoured all these short stories, sort of hilarious. And then I Googled something like authors similar to Wodehouse, and Damon Runyon came up. And I thought, really? But actually, he is quite... I can see why somebody somewhere has connected the two writers. There's this cast of characters who are a bit larger than life. They speak in a kind of heightened way, which is based on the way people actually did speak. And the stories are all a bit, you know, slightly absurdist. And very, very funny. And then I discovered the radio series, which is done fantastically well. I mean, it's very high production values and... You know, it sticks very closely to the original stories.
That's the trouble, Mr. Mr.
You may call me Broadway.
Well, Mr. Broadway, Deborah goes to the movies and she has seen tough guys and she has made up her mind that they are her ideals. To make things worse, there is a Joe Trivet in Erasmus who claims he once shook hands with a gangster.
That is dangerous work.
I don't believe him. I told him so.
And I really like the series, but then... I'm trying to track down, following leads on all of the different shows, trying to find out who might own them. And often he's trying to separate the recording rights from the original script rights, which is based on a short story. And in the case of Damon Runyon, that was owned by, it was produced by Mayfair Productions. So I was told by somebody that Alan Ladd Jr. owns all the Mayfair Productions stuff and couldn't verify that in the end. Then I was told that Sheldon Arbend owned all of the Damon Runyon stuff. And all I could find out about him was that he was deceased, but he was very litigious and that he had sued Steven Spielberg and James Stewart at different times. And I thought, oh, that can't be going down this path. I really need to find out. And in the end, it was getting so close and it seemed a little bit risky to use it without knowing fully who we had to pay. So that had to go in the end as well, which is a shame. But then just like a week before, the programme had been made, it was in the can, it was all ready to be played out from the system. And then I discovered that the rights are actually very obtainable and I do know now where to get them from in future. So I also got in touch with a guy. There's a show on BBC TV called Mastermind where people go on, I don't know if you have it over there, where people go on with a specialised subject. And I found this guy, his specialised subject was the stories of Damon Runyon or the world of Damon Runyon or something. And I tracked him down, thanks to the wonder of the internet, and said, "Are you the guy who was on Mastermind?" He said, "Yes, I am the guy who was on Mastermind." And so I got quite a lot of advice and stuff from him as well. And he was very excited about the show going out. And I had to break it to him in the end that, sorry, we're not using Damon Runyon's story after all.
The acknowledgements at the end of the program, not to give anything away, but it seemed that the bigger names of the old-time radio collecting and academic community were there. You know, you really reached out to a lot of people.
Well, I mean, my starting point was on Facebook. The old-time radio researchers group. I joined the group a while ago, and partly, I mean, this is before the idea for the program, I think, just to sort of, you know, a bit of chat about the subject that I was interested in. And then when I was pitching the idea to the BBC, I stuck a post on the group saying, hello, everybody, I'm a British enthusiast of American Golden Age Radio, pitching this idea, blah, blah, blah. If anybody has any suggestions or, you know, is able to help with research in any way. And lots of people are interested in helping. I mean, most of the messages were people saying, good luck, I can't wait to hear it. And but some people were able to come up with, you know, advice and that kind of thing. And it was little things like it's connecting the dots. Because it was just like one person would mention to somebody else and they'd mention somebody else. And it was through a guy called Sammy Jones, who was a member of the group, and he said, why don't you talk to Walden Hughes? Walden has a show on Yesterday USA. And then Walden knows Laura Leibowitz from the International Jack Benny fan club. So it's just like an email would go from one person, oh, could you help this guy out? Could you help that guy out? So everybody's been fantastically helpful and keen to help. A guy called Alec Cumming, who he wrote a book about the history of radio in New York, a lovely book with fantastic photographs. He was very helpful. He put me in touch with some very useful contacts. When I was floundering around with copyright and just like drowning, had no idea what I was supposed to be doing. I got some quite incisive advice from Martin Grams, who he sent me this quite long, detailed email about. He finished the email by saying, that's not what you want to hear. And it did make it sound very complicated. But actually, he did separate it all out. He said, you need to take into account all these different elements, music, script, blah, 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 blah. And people went out of the way. You know, people spent time. And it's been great. And oh, people sent me little clips. And one guy sent me a zip file of about, I don't know, 50 or 70 short clips from like sort of 10 seconds to 3 minute long. Interesting little bits, you know. It's been great. I mean, I've been really overwhelmed, actually, with how enthusiastic and helpful people have been in the group, which is why I was quite nervous about the programme going out in the end, because people are very passionate about the subject and, you know, you're bound to let everybody down in one way or the other. You know, you can't please all the people all the time. And I was balancing so many different things, the BBC demands and time demands and budgetary demands. But people have been very kind about it and people have enjoyed it. And I've had to sort of explain to people, look, this, even though you've been very helpful, it kind of wasn't for you guys. It was more for the British audience. And I was trying to kind of introduce the subject to a British audience, which has been, it's been very interesting actually to do, actually. But if it was for the OTR community, it would have been a very different programme. You know, it would have been, maybe it would have gone down a very, very obscure route and used material that's quite difficult to listen to, you know, quite sort of bad quality and that kind of thing, because people, if people are interested in the subject, they will kind of suffer their way. Oh, I do. I sit down and listen to some terrible recording. But you can't really inflict that upon a mainstream audience, you know. So anyway, people have been quite pleased with it, which is nice to hear.
You know, it reminds me of years ago, I was a keynote at a dinner for a bunch of retired scientists in Academy of Science, and they wanted me to talk about the Golden Age of Radio. And I recall being very nervous because I had a split-second thought, which is, well, what if they ask me how the older radios worked or, you know, something very in-depth? And I said to myself, wait a minute, they're scientists. They know exactly how a radio
works.
They know.
Yeah, well, they probably heard it as well. I mean, we've not met in person, but I'm assuming you're not old enough to have been around at the time.
It was funny, too. Like, afterwards, I took questions, and the first question was, hey, do you ever play such and such show on your program? And I said yes, and then from the other side of the room, someone started singing the theme song, and then the whole room erupted in song, and it was, that's really, you know, not surprising to hear, Dominic, about the old-time radio community, because they love to share information and be helpful, and also helpful in a way as to accuracy, whether it's how to spell B. Benaderet's name, the actress. There's debate on that, to who is correct about copyright. These things are important to the community for all the reasons people love being part of the community and have it as a hobby or a passion. And, you know, someone listening to a variety of these old shows, there seems to come a point of intimacy. It's beyond just the one-on-one experience of listening. It's kind of deeper somehow. It's like really getting comfortable with the cadence of the speech or the old expressions and feeling connected, let's say, to the warmth of an actor's voice. I'm wondering, in the past year that you've been working on this, was there a period in your listening or research that you felt, let's say, particularly close to the material?
Well, that's an interesting question. Yeah, I mean, not specifically to anything in particular, but I did find it very difficult to start cutting down the number of shows I had in my list, and I felt quite kind of protective over it, and I felt that I had to, you know, they need to hear all these programs, you know. I mean, in the end, one of the things I did was the Ray Bradbury, the Zero Hour.
Will destruction come more subtly, extended to us gently and innocently in, let's say, the hand of a child? Who knows in what manner Zero Hour may arrest the world we know?
That particular show was a double bill when it first went out. There was another story that went with it called There Will Come Soft Rains. And I took that out just because I could squeeze another show in there, you know. And I felt like we hadn't had any science fiction in there. And yeah, it's difficult, actually. And I would have liked to have had, I wanted to have some children's shows in there as well. The kids' science fiction, like Space Patrol, those kind of things. I would love to have had some of that in there, you know. It's great. It's very interesting. I mean, the thing is, you wouldn't expect an adult audience with their egg and bacon on a Saturday morning to be listening to Space Patrol, really.
Space Patrol! High adventure in the wild, vast reaches of space. Missions of daring in the name of interplanetary justice. Travel into the future with Buzz Corey, Commander-in-Chief of the Space Patrol.
So I kind of knew that I had to ditch that kind of stuff. But it was quite, I did feel quite attached to it. I felt quite sad for the people who didn't quite get on the program, you know, even though most of them are no longer with us and they wouldn't mind anyway. Lorene Tuttle and Jack Webb are two acts, I think, that I do feel quite sort of close to. I don't know what it is with, because Jack Webb is actually quite a prickly character in a way, and I don't really warm to him personally, particularly his character in Dragnet. He's so kind of dry and monotone. I don't know why I feel sort of drawn to him. And then Lorene Tuttle, I just love the fact that she was so ubiquitous. She was everywhere. And what I discovered was, when I was looking into her career, I'll mention a program she's in. So I've heard that program. Hang on a second. I'll go back. Oh, yeah, she is in that one. So I'd heard her work a lot already. Because she was so versatile, I hadn't even realised I'd been listening to her. So I became very fond of Lorene. I had a chunk in the show that didn't make it in the end, maybe for another show, about Hyman Brown. He does one of the, I used some material from Chuck Shaden's interviews with various Golden Age stars. And one of the people he interviews is Hyman Brown, the producer. And his interview is fantastic. It's full of gossip, and particularly about his early career and how he got started. And I would have liked to have used him. And I felt quite sad about not using him in the end.
Yeah, Hyman Brown, the director of Inner Sanctum and Bulldog Drummond, Gangbusters, a lot of big shows.
And he worked forever. I mean, his career was must have been 40 years in the business, or more, because he worked into the 70s and 80s, Hyman Brown. You know, he just wasn't in the era itself.
Yeah, when the host is going down the Giants of Radio Row, he did get that mention.
I'd like to do a program all about his work, actually. Maybe one about... I'd like to do a Giant series, a Hyman Brown one, a Norman Corwin, which is a possibility, actually. I've been looking in the BBC archives here, and there's quite a lot of Norman Corwin stuff because he did this series, An American in London During the War, Second World War, which was, I think, there was a version cut for the US audience and one cut for the British audience. So the ones that I found on the system here are, they have this posh clipped chap saying, Mr. Norman Corwin, the incredibly famous American broadcaster. And then it goes into Norman Corwin's bits where I found versions of the same show, but for the American audience online. And it doesn't have any of that, it just says a CBS announcer instead. So there's definitely a program to be made about Norman Corwin's wartime activities. We could do his whole life, but, you know, just the wartime activities could fill 3 hours, you know. Anyway, these are all possibilities for the future.
So to sort of wrap up here, there was an online comment that thanked you for playing a Jack Benny broadcast in this special. And they said that as a British OTR fan, this is an incredibly rare thing. Now, my understanding is that in England, radio drama is still pretty much a regular part of the air.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And comedy as well, actually. I mean, it's Radio 4. It has news. It has quite in-depth news programs. It also has drama and it has comedy. So over the decades, it's built up quite a big archive of stuff, which is what Radio 4 Extra then dips into for its stuff.
Because of that, I'm wondering how listeners there, to your perception anyhow, enjoy the older stuff. You know, is there room for nostalgia when new dramas and comedy are being regularly produced?
There definitely is. I mean, Radio 4 Extra, I saw that I was walking through the 4 Extra office earlier today, and they've got a printout from some report that says it's the most listened to digital station in the UK. So there obviously is, you know, a market for that kind of archive material. The comedy that's on 4 Extra is things like, I don't know how familiar you are with the British archive, but things like The Goon Show, the Paul Temple Mysteries. I think the problem, though, with comedy is, and this is why Jack Benny doesn't get a look in, well, because he didn't perform on the BBC for a start, so it's much more difficult to get the rights and everything. It's the references. I mean, comedy is the genre, I think, that travels least well in terms of... I mean, there's even the episode we played, there are jokes in there that are just lost on a modern audience and lost on a UK modern audience, certainly. There's references to kind of products that don't exist, and there's references to baseball that isn't really a thing here. That particular episode, there wasn't a lot of that, to be honest. And I think that you get away with most of it because there's a joke. Mr. Kitzel talks about a baseball player called Rabbi something, and his name is Rabbit something. So that we wouldn't understand that joke at all, but you understand it in context because, you know, it's the kind of the old Jewish guy, and you pick up from the context that there was a baseball player called Rabbit something. Is that right? There was a baseball player called Rabbit?
Oh, that one's flying over my head.
Did it as well? You see, I mean, maybe that's the age, yeah. So I think I was quite nervous about making a comedy choice for the show. And Jack Benny, in the end, we settled on him because the sort of universal, you know, the whole kind of meanness and the tight-fistedness is a kind of, you know, you can grasp a hold of that concept. And that particular episode was all about that. It was based on the fact that he was stingy. And then once you know, I tried to sort of introduce the characters a bit and explain who people were. Because also in the Jack Benny show and shows like that, the audience are familiar with the characters week in, week out there, you know, and lots of sort of... There's a joke in there about, what's his name, Don Wilson eats a lot. And it referred to at the end, the waitress says, Don Wilson's still eating or something from the beginning of the show. And that kind of, when I first listened to that episode, I didn't really notice it, really. It's only when I started looking into it, when I'm reading around the characters a bit more and trying to do a bit of research, I thought, oh, right, so the running joke that he's fat and he's always eating, you know. And if you played like 5-6 episodes of the Jack Benny show or similar shows, people then get into it. But I only had one, you know, 30-minute slot in this 1 3-hour program to play some comedy. And actually, it was Laura Leibowitz from the fan club who suggested that episode. Oh, it also has this whole section where Frankie Fontaine does impressions of Winston Churchill and James Cagney and Cary Grant. And so these are things that we could relate to now, you know. But I think it's tricky to kind of program a season of Jack Benny shows on a UK network just because of the references are so obscure now. But I was happy with that choice, actually. I was happy with that Jack Benny episode. And a few people have said, oh, I'd never even heard of him before, and I really like that.
And he did sell out the London Palladium when he visited when he was alive.
Did he really? I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very, very popular. And I think it's because of those common themes, like you're saying. He's stingy, he's, you know, terrible at the violin.
Yeah.
And also probably one of the, as you're well aware, one of the fewer comedians that is mostly setting everyone else up for the laugh rather than him doing the one-liner and getting the most laughs.
Yeah, the bit in that episode that we played, the bit that makes me laugh every time I heard it isn't a Jack line. It's when he's lying in bed and he mentions the 50 cents he's given and the dishes crash down in the kitchen. And he says, Rochester, what's happened in the kitchen? He said, I don't know, I'm in bed. Which was, it made me laugh every time, you know, and I must have heard it about 15 times as I was putting the program together.
Unless there's anything else you wanted to add, I would invite my listeners to check this out. There will be a link on the podcast page to BBC Radio 4 Extra, where you can listen to it for the next month and stream it online. So, Dominic DeLarghi, thank you so much for speaking with me for the TTY Dollar podcast. Congratulations on the broadcast. It's a thrill for someone like myself, who's a researcher and a broadcaster with these old shows, that it got across the pond.
Thanks for having me. It's been great talking to you.
And thanks for listening to my conversation with Dominic DeLarghi of the BBC. Pretty exciting stuff. And you can hear that 3-hour broadcast for the next month. It does have an expiration date, unlike many of these old shows, at the TTY Dialer podcast page at wrvo.org. I'll be providing a link to the BBC Radio 4 Extra program called The Golden Age of American Radio. And that does it for the TTY Dialer podcast this week. I know we don't usually break format too much. Normally you get an old-time radio commercial and some background on that, some profiles of some of the shows and performers from radio's yesteryear, and of course a look at the shows coming up for the week. I'll be back with that next week. And if you'd like, you can hear all of the archived broadcasts, which still kind of hold up, at our website, wrvo.org. And if you have any questions or comments for me about the podcast, Tune to Yesterday or Old Time Radio, just email me, mark@wrvo.org. That's M-A-R-K @wrvo.org. Until next week, thanks a lot for listening.